I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. As promised, we talk about healthcare this hour of the program. It seems like we have spent years talking about healthcare on this program. This hour, what plans do the Senate Republicans have for a healthcare bill? Will elements of the recently passed House bill be included, or are Senate Republicans starting from scratch? Can Democrats and healthcare groups who are opposed to this new plan protect the Affordable Care Act in some way? We're going to have two guests with us this hour. We're going to be starting with Paige Winfield Cunningham from the Washington Post. Paige has written extensively about health care at the Post. She also writes the Health 202, which is the Washington Post health policy newsletter, which just launched today, as a matter of fact. Paul Howard joining us later in the hour, senior fellow and the policy director at the Manhattan Institute Center for Medical Progress. Back in January, he wrote Ideas for the New Administration for Urgent Health Care Reforms. Number one on his list was to repeal Obamacare and transition to catastrophic health insurance plans linked to expanding health savings accounts. All hour, I'm sure we're going to have many phone calls on this issue, as we did yesterday. Our number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Paige, hello. Thank you very much for being with us.
Great to be on. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, our great pleasure. You wrote in a recent piece that the GOP healthcare bill is likely to be a big political hot potato in next year's elections. We're starting to see there was an interesting piece in the Post today about an Iowa congressman who's receiving pushback against his vote, and we're probably going to see a lot of that in the recess to come. How big will the pushback be? Could this be a true political liability for a lot of House Republicans?
Well, you know, a lot of people are comparing this to the 2010 elections when you saw a lot of Democrats who voted for the Affordable Care Act lose their seats. And then, of course, Republicans win the House by largely running against the Affordable Care Act. And in the same way, you saw a lot of town halls, Democrats facing town halls in the months leading up to that. And now Republicans are experiencing the same thing. I think there's a real palpable fear next year But both for conservative members in the House, of course, who fear being primaried from the right by members who either accuse them of not repealing Obamacare as they've promised to do or of passing a bill that doesn't fully repeal Obamacare, but then also challenges for the moderate Republicans who are vulnerable next year. Democrats are poised and ready to target these Republicans, and that's why it was so hard to get many of the moderates on board, because just what you mentioned at this town hall last night, they're hearing this pushback from their constituents because the Republican health care bill would result in many millions of people losing their coverage. So, yeah, it's a very, very politically sticky situation Republicans are in right now.
Why didn't the House Republicans wait a little bit longer to get a CBO report on this to figure out what exactly was in the bill, to get some sense of public sentiment on this?
Well, to clear things up a little bit, they did get a CBO score for the overall bill. It was since amended, but it's probably the case that the amendments aren't large enough to have significantly shifted the coverage predictions or the cost of the bill. So I think Republicans are probably right when they argue that they sort of had a basic idea for what the bill would do. Why they didn't wait, though, for a final CBO score, I think was because, you know, once the speaker sensed that there was momentum in that direction for getting across that finish line of 216 votes in the House, they didn't want to wait a second more. It was hard enough as it was to get enough of those moderates and Freedom Caucus members on board. But, of course, that opened them up to criticisms that they were being quite hypocritical without, you know, voting with a conference that was fully and completely informed about what the effects would be of the final legislation.
You've written recently that the Senate may not even use the health care bill that the House Republicans passed this week. They may start from scratch, as Susan Collins has indicated. Are they starting from scratch or not?
It appears that they are discussing the House bill, but yeah, I think it's probably accurate to describe it as they're going to put together their own legislative proposal. There's a working group of 13 Republicans right now. In fact, I just got back from talking to some of them after they met this morning, and they were specifically talking about changes to Medicaid. But you know, another point on regular order here. Of course, Republicans have promised that this would go through regular order, but pretty much everyone at this point acknowledges there aren't going to be Senate committee hearings on this legislation. It's going to be drafted behind closed doors with these Republican members, and then released at some point, probably in the next couple months, and then to go directly to the Senate floor for a vote. But you know, the House bill already had a lot of elements in it that were probably going to be stripped out in the Senate anyway because of these budget reconciliation rules. So that was already sort of on the rocks in a sense. So I think that Majority Leader Mitch McConnell thinks that the most likely pathway to success is trying to build up their own legislation around what they understand to be enough, you know, common ground to get that 50 votes that they would need to actually pass it in the Senate.
Mm. Well, let's talk about Medicaid. What were the Republican senators you were talking to today saying about Medicaid as part of the Republican plan? Medicaid would really be scaled back substantially and reduce subsidies available to many, many Americans in this country. A lot of poor people, from my reading of this, would lose health care coverage.
Right. Well, as you know, the Affordable Care Act pretty dramatically expanded Medicaid for states that chose to accept it. And that's become a real sticking point for Republicans. There's around 18 to 20 Republicans in the Senate whose states actually decided to expand Medicaid. And two of those Republicans notably are facing really tough races next year, Dean Heller and Jeff Flake in Arizona. And so they're going to be really interesting senators to watch because they tend to be members who would have criticisms for the Affordable Care Act and sort of dislike its big expansion of federal programs, and yet they're getting a lot of pushback from people in their state who have gained coverage because of the Medicaid expansion.
Mm-hmm.
So that's going to be a big point of contention between those Republicans who are from states that embrace Medicaid expansion and the Republicans from the states that rejected it.
Paige, there's a lot of confusion about pre-existing conditions. We're getting tons of comments from listeners about this, so let's take one that exemplifies most of the comments we're getting. Tracy writes on Facebook, "I'd like to know what the list of pre-existing conditions would be. There's a lot of speculation and misinformation out there."
That's a really good question, and I think that would be have to be put to individual insurers because that has varied depending on which plan you're enrolled in. But I think what can be said for sure is there are many, many millions of Americans with pre-existing conditions, many Americans with diabetes, cancer patients, you know, the whole range. One point about this whole discussion is a lot of the confusion has centered around what is a true protection for somebody with a pre-existing condition.
Mm-hmm.
Is it enough to require that insurers cover them, or do you also have to ban insurers from jacking up premiums for these folks? And I think a strong feeling among Democrats and also just many health policy wonks is that it's not people. You're basically excluding people with pre-existing conditions if you don't include some requirement that insurers can't charge them more than healthy patients.
And what's your sense about Obamacare in this country? Is it a failing system? Are there a lot of people who are seeing their rates just skyrocket? Are a lot of people very, very upset about Obamacare? Do they want to see it tweaked? Where are we?
Like most things in healthcare, that's a complicated answer. I'll say the things that I feel are the most problematic for Obamacare, which are that Obamacare cut the uninsured rate in about half, but it is still the fact that about 15 million or so Americans lack health insurance. So the law did not go as far as many had hoped in reducing that uninsured rate, and getting those additional people to enroll has proven very hard for the Obama administration. Another real problem has been in the marketplaces. Now, it should be noted that the marketplaces are state-run, so the marketplaces in some states are fine. In California, they've had modest premium increases and quite a lot of plans to choose from. But then you have other states where insurers are dropping out. Iowa has been the most recent one in the news lately. Illinois has also been hit pretty hard. And some really hefty premium increases that the subsidies haven't been large enough to allow some people to afford their coverage. There are definitely some legitimate concerns with Obamacare. And, Democrats have been forced to acknowledge some of those problems. But it's sort of been interesting that all of this drama around the Republican repeal replace plan has drawn some attention from, the real problems that we're seeing with the health care law.
Mm-hmm. Does this new plan give significant tax relief to very high income people in this country?
Yeah, the law would repeal virtually all of the Affordable Care Act taxes, which is sort of its one selling point for the healthcare industry. It would repeal the Cadillac tax on high-cost health plans, and that actually, it should be noted that Democrats and Obama had agreed to delay that tax for a number of years. It had been lobbied against pretty heavily by the insurance industry. But the idea with the Cadillac tax is one that makes a lot of sense when you think about it. The goal was to incentivize employers against offering these really expensive, cushy health plans that end up sort of nudging up healthcare costs overall, and that was supposed to be a tool to kind of prompt them to offer perhaps leaner plans that could help to combat this problem of double-digit increases in healthcare spending over the last few years. The taxes is actually, as I mentioned, would be repealed in the Republican healthcare bill, and from what I'm hearing, would most likely be repealed in any final version of the legislation that President Trump might sign.
Mm. Just give me your thoughts on this. We have talked about and debated this issue for years and years and years. Why is it so incredibly difficult to come up with, in this country, good coverage for people at a price they can afford?
I would give two answers to that question. One is that, when Republicans say, well, we just need more competition and we need insurers to sell across state lines, you have all these plans to choose from. Normally that argument works, right? When you have more competition, it bumps plans are forced to compete and it bumps prices down. But it's not a pure market in the healthcare system, because the payers, the insurers, are different than the patients. And so you already have that difference. And the way that insurance works, by definition, is that the costs are spread among a large population of people. And so it comes down to who are the enrollees in insurance. And if you don't convince people who are healthy and cheap to enroll, mm-hmm. then the costs are going to be higher for everyone else. The other part of this is that in the U.S., we spend more on health care than any other developed country, and yet we also have better health care than many other countries. And there have been huge medical advances in the last couple of decades. Survival rates are up for many different kinds of cancers and other diseases, which is a great thing. But we also have very, very expensive drugs that help people stay alive longer and have a higher quality of life. But ultimately, somebody has to pay that bill. So it ends up, that cost ends up being spread around to everybody who buys health insurance.
I don't know. We did this show yesterday on the ProPublica report. They've done two reports now on the amount of waste, which they say is close to one quarter of all the money spent on health care is wasted. Things that are thrown away, huge landfills filled with equipment from hospitals that is perfectly fine or maybe even never been used. The number of drugs that are thrown down and flushed down the toilet in nursing homes in the country, huge, millions of dollars. And you would think somewhere along the line, some congressional big investigation would take place to look at the cost of health care.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, I mean, absolutely. But I think that goes back to the problem of it not being a true marketplace in a way. If hospitals were billing patients directly who had without insurance, who had a limited capacity to pay, you know that hospitals would be looking at ways to cut costs in other ways. Mm-hmm. But instead, we have big agreements forged between these big insurers and these hospitals. And if you have private insurance, the biggest bills are paid by these private insurers. And so I think you lack that system of incentives to try to cut costs and find more efficient ways of delivering care. And there are elements in the Affordable Care Act which try to experiment with ways of helping doctors to go leaner where they can, or to try to cut costs, or maybe don't prescribe the most expensive drug when another one would do just as well. But figuring out how to structure that in a way that providers are incentivized is really, really tricky and something that we haven't fully figured out yet.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Joining us the first half hour is Paige Winfield Cunningham. She covers health care at the Washington Post, currently covering the Senate today. She writes the Health 202, Washington Post's health policy newsletter, just launching today. We're looking at the Republican bill that passed the House, what the Senate is likely to do. And what do you think about all of this? You're the people who we all do. We all need health care. So what do you think about the discussion so far? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email is talk@wpr.org. And if you want to leave messages on Facebook, we'd like to hear from you. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll be with you in a moment here on the Ideas Network. Let's go to phone calls. They're coming in fast and furious this hour. We start with Jack in Eau Claire. Hi, Jack.
Hello.
Hi. Go ahead,
yes,
Jack.
Yes, hello. Yes.
You're on, Jack. Go ahead.
All right. Yes, my question is, why not offer the option, especially one of the first, I guess I'd start, one of the biggest criticisms of the Affordable Care Act is that currently one-third of the counties in the country have only one insurer, and now there are some reported that have none offering insurance. Why don't we have the option of buying into Medicare if we're under 65, buying into Medicare and paying a full cost premium? There'd be no cost to the taxpayers. This would allow Medicare effectively to compete with private insurers in those areas. I know that would be found to be offensive by some because it's more government involvement in health care. But why should it matter if Medicare can offer affordable and competitive insurance to others? Why not allow them purchase the premium from Medicare?
Paige, thank you, Jack.
Well, this idea of a single payer system or a public option where people can buy in, of course, is an idea that Bernie Sanders and other Democrats have wanted for years, but Republicans have really resisted. There are some problems that it would certainly solve in the healthcare system. But it should also be noted that this would be expensive for the government to do, of course. Medicare has its own set of financial woes. It's going to be insolvent I forget the exact date, but it's within the next 10, 15 years, I believe. And so you would have to figure out how to fund a system like that. But if you are looking to move the U.S. toward a, you know, very low uninsured rate, like you see in a lot of European countries, then going with a public option would probably be the way to do that, because it would indeed offer coverage for people at a more affordable rate.
And certainly a huge number of countries have figured out how to fund it. They have single payer.
Right, exactly. Well, I mean, the U.S. is sort of an outlier because we're like one of the only developed countries that doesn't have single payer or at least a public option. I think the positive out of that possibly is that there's more access to care if you're on a private insurance system possibly. I mean, the complaint in some European countries is that you have to get on these waiting lists, and of course you're prioritized by what your medical need is, but it can take a really long time because the providers are less incentivized to take patients on these plans because they reimburse at lower rates than perhaps private insurers do in the U.S. But certainly in terms of expanding coverage, that has been shown as the public option has been shown as kind of the most effective way to do that.
And what's strange is I'm hearing from more than one Republican that they're saying that they believe we will have single payer within the next 7 years.
Well, you look at what the Affordable Care Act tried to do, and it kind of chose this middle ground, and it is still based on private insurance. So the federal government essentially subsidizes people to buy private plans, and that's really expensive. And it's also really hard for the government to create the mix of enrollees. Certainly there was the requirement for people to buy coverage, but the penalty, many felt, wasn't large enough, and so people decided to pay the penalty instead of enrolling in coverage. Plus, the Obama administration didn't really enforce the penalty that much over the past few years. But Obamacare is just sort of this weird middle ground where it's not government-provided health insurance. It still tries to work through the private markets, but it ends up being really expensive for the government and not necessarily producing the results that everybody wanted, which is for everyone to have coverage at an affordable rate.
Jack, thanks for your call. Dennis in Beloit, hi.
Yes, my comment concerns, I've never understood why, well, I understand it's in the language of legislation, but why Medicare can't negotiate the price of drugs. To me, that's just unconscionable. Given the volume of muscle that Medicare has, the fox is in the chicken house. And to me, it's just a unconscionable giveaway to the pharmaceutical companies, given how the escalation of prices. Can we ever see a situation where there will be effective negotiation for Medicare on drug costs?
I would say the answer to that question is probably no, at least in the next few years. You probably recall that Trump, during his campaign, was sort of unusual as a Republican in that he was calling for allowing this price negotiation. But you may notice that ever since he took office in January, you haven't heard him call for that very much. And it could be that he's really recognizing the fact that it's a political non-starter for his Republican colleagues in the House and Senate. Pharma's lobby is just very strong. I can't imagine a scenario where House Speaker Ryan and Majority Leader Mitch McConnell would agree to implementing a policy like that. And so I would be surprised to see the White House really push for something in that direction anytime soon.
Mm. And what is the White House involvement now in fashioning a Republican bill? Sarah Huckabee, whatever her last name is now, Sanders, was filling in last Friday for Sean Spicer, and she said, and you quote her in your article recently, "Never underestimate this president. He's shown time and time again when he's committed to something, it's going to get done."
Well, I think that Trump certainly has been pushing for this, but I think most of the the effectiveness really lies in Vice President Mike Pence. He's the one who came to the Hill in March and April when House Republicans were kind of huddling and the Freedom Caucus was meeting and trying to figure out how to reach consensus on the bill. I can't even remember the number of times Pence came. It was quite a number of visits to the Hill. You know, Pence was in the House. He knows a lot of these guys. He's a conservative in ways that Trump certainly isn't, and I think that Pence was able to talk in the language that the Freedom Caucus likes to hear, and he sort of knew what to say to try to bring them on board with this. There's a lot of trust of Pence where there might be a lot of distrust of Trump where members don't know exactly where he stands on things, but I think that's why you saw the White House really deploy Pence. And in fact, Pence was actually, I believe, is on the Hill right now and is meeting with Senate Republicans. So I think you're going to see more of that involvement from the vice president as the Senate tries to hammer out a health care bill.
Mm-hmm. One more call for you. Steve and Trago, hi.
Hello. It seems to me that if 320 million of us were on the same health insurance plan, wouldn't we be able to bargain for not just more reasonable drug prices, but more reasonable prices across the board? everything from various procedures to surgeries to hospital stays. Isn't it true that at this point the savings in that scenario are unknown?
Well, yeah, I mean, you're right. It's true. If we had a single-payer system, that gives the government huge control to set prices and to, you know, I mean, essentially dictate how much it will pay for certain procedures. And I think that's why, you know, one other element of this that I didn't mention earlier is if Congress ever went down that path of single payer, you would see huge, huge pushback from the healthcare industry, likely from the hospitals and the doctors, who now are relying on a lot of the reimbursements from the private insurers, who will pay them more, and really they say they lose money under the reimbursements through Medicaid and Medicare, and so you're right, it would bring down costs in that sense because providers would be forced to offer services for less money. But politically speaking, there just seems to be too many obstacles to getting there right now.
Mm. So just where is the timeline here? The Senate will deliberate this for about a month, Paige, and then come up with their bill?
Well, what we're waiting on right now is a score from the CBO on that final version of the House bill. But as we're waiting on that, this group of 13 Senate Republicans are meeting. They just had their third meeting this morning. Majority Leader McConnell is refusing to sort of set a timeline, but what I've heard from folks is that the idea is to have something ready before the recess in August, and then come back in September perhaps and try to pass it.
All right. Paige, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you.
Paige Winfield Cunningham, she covers healthcare at the Washington Post, and she writes the Washington Post health policy newsletter, which just started today, and it's titled The Health 202. Paul Howard is joining us now. Paul is a senior fellow and policy director at the Manhattan Institute Center for Medical Progress. He wrote a very interesting piece in January, kind of a letter to the new administration outlining what he would like to see for healthcare reform. And number one on the list is repeal Obamacare and transition to catastrophic health insurance plans linked to expanded health savings accounts. He is our guest now. Our phone calls still welcome for him, and our phone number is still 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hello, Paul.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
Yeah, thanks very much for being with us. Why don't we first hear what your thoughts are about the bill that the House passed? Did you overall think it was a good effort or not?
Well, you know, I think that the Republicans are thinking about the right problems. There are some good things in the bill, but it also has some significant challenges. I think, the problem they're trying to grapple with is, you know, look, for people who are, you know, very low income or who have significant health conditions, pre-existing health conditions, Obamacare, the ACA, is undoubtedly a big win for those populations. We've also got people, you know, millions of them, who are essentially paying full freight for the ACA policies. They're very expensive. They're bearing the full brunt of cost increases, about 24%, I think, this year. About 6.5 million are paying the ACA penalty and going uninsured, and another 12 million some odd people have been excused from buying insurance because, you know, for one reason or another, a hardship exemption, they just can't afford it. Hmm. So the populations are different, and we need to find one solution that bridges both of them, and that looks at affordability for people who have low cost, low risk, get them back in the market. That can lower premiums for everybody else. I think that's the right directionality. I think the House's approach still needs a lot of work on the design of its tax credits. And, of course, you have to grapple with, you know, what do you do with states that have expanded Medicaid versus states that haven't? Those are some of the big challenges the Senate's going to take up.
Would you agree that some of those Republicans are in political hot water when it comes to next year's midterm elections because of their votes on this bill?
Well, you know, one of the big challenges, you know, for Congress, at least for the House, is obviously the politics has fragmented and polarized. So members, you know, in safe districts are not really seeing any kind of challenges, and their incentive is to either go further blue or further red, however you want to phrase it. And then there are people who are still, you know, a small number, but a significant ones who are caught in these swing districts that are either purple or swing back and forth. And those people are going to be feeling heat. the better thing I think about the Senate's role is senators represent states, not districts, and they have a very different perspective on these challenges. It's broader, and they're going to be listening very closely to the concerns of their governors. And I think that, we're going to see a replay of the debate between the House moderates and conservatives on the Senate side, but probably aimed at a higher level of getting more buy-in and, of course, getting a better score relative to the current state of coverage through the Congressional Budget Office.
Mm-hmm. You called for, you wrote this letter, well, outline, I don't know if you sent it to anybody, I'm sure you probably did, of what you would like to see. Number one on the list, and I'd like you to talk more about this, repeal Obamacare and transition to catastrophic health insurance plans linked to expanding health savings accounts. Tell me more about that.
Right. So, you know, one of the ways that we finance, you know, healthcare right now is really, let's say, through the employer system, where everybody gets tax advantage insurance through their employers. Everybody likes that type of insurance, but it also encourages high costs, cost inflation, because people at the margins aren't thinking about the relative value of the things, the prices they're given, and it encourages people to take more things in, pre-tax care, in other words, higher premiums rather than post-tax dollars used for out-of-pocket services. People fall in the cracks into the individual insurance market because this is either their first job or maybe they have a pre-existing condition, they can't work, but they don't qualify for Medicare or Medicaid. And how do you think about the groups of people who are in that population? It's, you know, I guess, probably about 40 million people in total. The ACA, when it's fully implemented, is going to cover about 20 million, 25 million. Still about 27 million people, according to the CBO, are going to be left without insurance. So one thing, fix I think we should look at for this population is, at least for baseline, a coverage, an insurance vehicle that's focused around costs that would otherwise bankrupt you, you know, that would cause you to lose your house or put you in deep financial debt, that should protect you against those expenses. That's kind of the true purpose of insurance, but leave more routine out-of-pocket costs for a competitive market where providers would compete around finding better ways to deliver those services at lower cost more efficiently, while still recognizing one of the big problems, I think, with the high-deductible plans today is a lot of people don't have money in them. So if we're going to be serious about implementing this in the individual market, I think Republicans, conservatives, moderates, whatever, need to think about financing those HSAs up front with dollars so that someone who is low income, you know, right now under the ACA, they're getting cost-sharing subsidies. Well, we would put those into a health savings account. So the money to pay for drugs, doctor's visits, other things would be there for those people. And then for other higher-income people, they would get a lower premium, but they would pay more out-of-pocket. And then we could talk about some other ways to design those plans to make them more effective. But I think that that's broadly the kind of structure we should move towards for services that can be afforded out of pocket with more help for people at the lower income end.
Mm-hmm. And you would be assured, I'm not sure how, that there would be a lower cost for those services that you would pay out of pocket?
Well, you know, we do see in places, like say retail clinics originally started out, you know, in CVS's and Walgreens and places like that, charging very transparent, very low prices. There have been a few studies early on that found that those plans offered very competitive, high-quality care, less expensively than doctor's offices, and they're also more convenient. So for services like that, that are very low cost, run by nurse practitioners, you could think of other things you can offer. There are some physicians that are beginning to offer what are called direct primary care practices. You know, people think of concierge care as something just for the wealthy, but there are people in Washington State and other states who have basically started subscription medical services for $75, $100 a month, for individuals and families that offer, you know, all the primary care you need, telemedicine, you know, electronic medical records, free generic drugs, basic x-rays, all in that price. Because they're outside the insurance system and they're just taking cash and allows them to jettison a lot of overhead. So that part of the market I still think can evolve a long way. The parts that are still going to be challenging are the things that people can't effectively shop for. It's hospitalizations, specialist physicians, other things like that that are very high dollar, high cost. Maybe at some point we can get to them or think about other tools for dealing with those costs. But I think those are the two parts of the market you think about: low-cost, low-risk services, and then higher-cost, higher-risk services that still should be covered by true insurance.
Mm-hmm. Do you think we're going to go to single-payer within 7 years?
You know, I know there's a lot of frustration out there. I think probably not, and I think your earlier speaker alluded to, which is to say, the reason that those other countries, and when we say single payer, I mean there are lots of different systems, right? The German system
right.
is different from the French system, is different from the Canadian and the UK. They're all different. They're all unique culturally. So they've been lucky because they started out with basically slower cost growth, government negotiating prices 50 years ago, 75 years ago. Their medical inflation rates have not actually been very different from ours. In some cases, ours is actually slower because we're all facing the same problems. We've all got many new technologies, many of them high value that we're covering. We've got aging populations that are getting older and more prone to serious diseases like cancer and diabetes. And so the U.S., if the government was just to step in and take over, say, employer-sponsored insurance, take over all the state obligations for Medicaid, and then do what, you know, Senator Sanders has suggested, which is offer all of this care without copays or deductibles, that is enormously expensive. That would be trillions and trillions of dollars of new spending. That is, you know, for the people, I think, who scored on the left, who scored Senator Sanders' plan during the primary, said, look, this is just not going to save any money. It's going to be incredibly more expensive. So I think the Obama approach, and if you look, I mean, look, there are some really serious concerns about the Republican approach, but they're both aiming towards the following. Pre-existing condition protections, tax credits in one form or another for the individual market, and some way of backstopping insurers to make the market more stable. I think that middle way that we're looking at now can be successfully implemented. It just needs to be done in a different way than what we're seeing now. So I'm hopeful that we'll get a better, smarter system that builds on the best of the U.S. system, which is incredible innovation, but at the same time, obviously, people are falling through the cracks, and we need to address that.
Paul Howard is our guest this part of the show. He's Senior Fellow and Policy Director at the Manhattan Institute's Center for Medical Progress. And we're going to be welcoming phone calls for him. A couple lines are open right now. They soon will not be. So if you'd like to call in, why don't you do so right now? 800-486-8655. What's the future of American healthcare is the question of the hour. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go to phone calls. Many of them coming in. We start with Sam in Milwaukee. Hello, Sam.
Hi there. I have a question for the guests about some of the additions to the Republican health care bill that passed the House. So it, from what I can see, what allowed it to pass the House was giving more power to the states when it comes to this bill, whether it's letting the states have a waiver to decide the essential health benefits or a waiver to hike premiums for pre-existing conditions. And this seems to the goal of this seems to appease the House Freedom Caucus. But my question for you is, how could this be beneficial for anyone? I've heard people say, like, the states won't use the waivers, but Scott Walker just said last week that he would consider that. So my question is, politically, why would this be an option on the table? And just morally, why would this be something that the Republicans would want to consider? Thank you.
Thanks very much for the call, Sam.
Right. Look, I think that that's a great question. And also I would say the Republicans have not done great messaging around this in a thoughtful way, which is to say the way that the bill is structured is to say you can only get one of these waivers if you demonstrate, I think, one of three or four conditions. The only people who would be open to this would be people who have a lapse in continuous coverage. So if you let your coverage drop for some period of time, you could be re-risk rated for a period of time. But states could only get waivers for doing that if they showed that their plans would improve lower premiums, lower costs, improve the quality of coverage, or do a couple of other things like balance out the risk pool. So there is a serious issue here, which is the current structure of what the ACA is trying to do to get people to buy into coverage. There's a mandate tax. And according to the IRS, 6.5 million people are paying the tax but not buying insurance, and another 12 million people have been excused. They have hardship exemptions. They're not buying insurance either. So one of the thinking here is that we should strengthen what are called continuous coverage requirements. So once you buy insurance, if you can hold it, that you will get the same rate forever. So you'll still get that community rating at the age that you're at. So you buy it when you're 25, you get the 25-year-old rate. Even if you're later sick, when you're 40, same thing. So that could be a stronger incentive for people to get and hold coverage. Now, I think you should add some guardrails to that. And even if someone lost coverage, because we do know that people are going to go through gaps in coverage, you should put in some hardship exemptions there, or have a high-risk pool, some coverage mechanism at the back end to say, look, even if somebody loses their coverage, we're not going to let them go without coverage if they have cancer. I mean, this is a delicate balance. Clearly, the ACA's structure is not working either, and they're trying to think through, okay, what ways can we do this? I think it's likely that what the states would want to do is experiment with some of these reinsurance tools, high-risk pool tools, to try and cover these populations, give insurers better incentives for covering them and getting these people and keeping them covered over time. And then think about within essential benefits, again, we were talking before, not all benefits are the same. So hospitalization, you're not really going to shop around for that effectively if you have a very serious condition. On the other hand, some of these other services, you might want to vary cost sharing across them. So I think those are the things states are probably going to look at really hard. No governor, I would say, is going to want a headline that says that they are casting sick people out onto the street with no options. I don't think that's going to happen. But explaining how you're actually trying to improve the status quo and making it work is Republicans' challenge right now.
Paul, how do you fund a high-risk pool then?
Lots of different ways. So the AHCA has put $100 billion into something called the Patient and State Stabilization Fund and added, I think, another $15 billion for high-risk pools and then kicked in a little bit more money. Let's say we're talking $130 billion all in. So HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services, would have to figure out a way to think about what conditions or what would qualify as high-cost conditions or what's called in the insurance language an attachment point. So if someone, say, had a very serious medical condition, let's just say multiple sclerosis, and we were spending $200,000 a year on them, a reinsurance program would say we would step in and cover 90% of the costs after $150,000. So this wouldn't take it entirely off of the insurer's books. They'd still be responsible for managing some cost there to give them an incentive to manage it well. But the government would step in at the back end and reduce the cost of these high-cost patients. Remember that in small markets, especially in rural states, a handful of these patients can really drive up the cost in these markets. So that would be a responsible way of doing it. I think that's just nonpartisan. I think on the left or the right, there are health policy wonks on both sides who would say that's a responsible thing. And I think some defenders of the ACA would look at it as an improvement if in the Republican bill they said, look, there's going to be permanent reinsurance or a permanent well-structured high-risk pools. That could take some of these high costs out of the market and lower premiums across the board.
Well, I think that people are really worried. It's their health care, as you well know. You study all of this. But if you have a child who is born who's going to need repeated surgeries for a long period of time, a couple questions. Are there plans, does the current plan that came out of the Republican side, or is the Senate thinking about a plan that will make sure that this person during his or her lifetime can have whatever surgeries are necessary, may run up into the millions during the course of a lifetime? Will there be a cap on making sure that you can have health coverage? Will there be no cap on this so you can have those kinds of surgeries? And doesn't that risk pool have to be funded at a much greater level than what you were just describing, considering the number of people who have really catastrophic illness?
Well, the number of people in the individual insurance market that have been estimated to have really high-cost, serious pre-existing conditions, remember, we're talking about a residual market. It's about 7% of the U.S. population that falls into this market. It's probably 2 or 3 million people out of 30 or 40 million in total. So it's a relatively small sliver, but very high expense. And that's just true in healthcare, right? 5% of the population is probably 50% of the costs. So experts have estimated that it would probably cost about $15 to $20 billion annually in federal funding to make those high-risk pools work. The Republicans aren't there yet. They need to get to that number. So I'd say, yes, you need to do that. Secondly, I'd say, traditionally plans in the individual market have actually been pretty good about, covering these kinds of episodes. So, after a birth, you have a certain amount of time to add a child to your policy. Even if they have some existing health condition, you can add them to your policy. I don't think that's going to change in any state. There was another concern about sexual assault. I think it was 45 or 48 states have already mandated coverage of services for those conditions. I find it, and I think Washington Post, the fact checker there, actually did a story just a couple days ago on this and raided the claim that Republicans would remove those protections as untrue. So, states, again, are not going to do terrible things for the purpose of doing terrible things. I think that's a disservice to legislators in the states. And especially the problem with insurance is not that insurers are, you know, evil and conniving. It's that if there isn't money available to pay for a high-cost patient who's never had insurance before, someone has to step up and cover that person. They're happy to offer coverage provided that the cost of doing so, what's called the actuarial cost of covering that person, which is no longer insurance, it's just health care, is paid. So if you can do that appropriately, we can do both. We can lower costs for younger and healthier enrollees, attract them back into the market with a mix of carrots and sticks, and we can ensure that this population, who I think, you know, this is consensus now in American politics, that population needs to be covered who have pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm. Sam, thanks for the call. Joe in Appleton, hi.
Hi, I have a question for the guest regarding HSA-compatible health insurance. My question regards to the cost curve. You have a few people who will be very sick, and they might have, say, six figures of medical expenses. Those are covering, are going to take up so much of the bill. How is a high deductible going to make a difference for them?
Right, right. No, it's a great question. I think, again, we're talking, oftentimes when we talk about care, we're kind of lumping populations together. So the way I'd think about it is the following. Over the course of someone's life, we're going to, you know, the government, is going to spend through tax advantage dollars an awful lot of money on them. Health savings accounts can balance off those costs over time by allowing people to build up nest eggs for that part of medical care that can be paid for out of pocket. For the other parts, the very high-cost parts, you can begin thinking of more tools that encourage market-like behaviors, even with people who are 100% subsidized. So the California Pension Retirement Fund, CalPERS, has done some really interesting things around hip and knee transplants and diagnostics. They went to some L.A. area hospitals and said, we're going to essentially give you a bundle for the payment of a hip and knee transplant, let's say $30,000. 10 or 15 hospitals said, we'll take that. And if people want to get $0 care, they go to those hospitals. If they want to go to someplace else that's more expensive, they're paying out of pocket. And then what they found was those other hospitals lowered costs to become eligible for this program. Excuse me. So this is a place where you think of two things. The Healthcare Cost Institute and others have said that as much as 33% of employer-provided care could be shoppable. Remember that there's a lot of MRIs, basic diagnostics, other things like that, that can be shopped once people know what the prices are and where the affordable providers are. And then the rest of it, it's about thinking of really innovative ways to drive competition. So, yes, health savings accounts are not going to be the solution for everything and certainly not for everyone. And I'd also suggest that you could link them with any kind of plan. So it could be a catastrophic health, HSA plan. Maybe it's simply a traditional HMO that still comes with a big deductible. But finding ways to use that savings to encourage consumers and where it works inside of any plan design, I think, would be an improvement from where we are.
Yeah. And one comment on the HSA. I was confused about if you were saying the government would put money into these accounts. Penny writes this, HSAs do nothing. You have to have money to put into an HSA, and most people don't have the funds to do this. It's a moneymaker for the insurance companies and lending institutions.
Well, what it actually does is it lowers administrative costs for insurers, which allows them to lower their premiums. It can also encourage competition among providers who are delivering those services before the deductible, because people then start looking around and say, do I need an MRI at this hospital that costs $1,000 or $1,500, or can I go to this freestanding clinic where it's $100? That kind of shopping is beneficial. But I think for low-income patients who we're talking about here, it is about, for, let's say, shopping on the exchanges or shopping on the market, you know, saying here's amount of money that we're going to put. Essentially, you know, the ACA, Obamacare, has cost-sharing reductions that go to the insurers. Instead, put them in the accounts of the individuals. So I think that that's the right approach. It protects the people who most need protection against it. And then I think employers need to increasingly think about, funding their HSAs as well. The reality is that this money comes out of all of our pockets, whether it's employer-provided care or any other program. All that money comes from our salaries, our pensions, our wages. And so getting better competition, lower costs, more efficiency over time actually allows more of that money to flow back into our own pockets to use for other parts of our lives. So that's what we're trying to do.
Paul, thank you very much for being with us. Thanks. It's hard
really
to keep up
pleasure.
With
Thank
it
you.
All, sir. We appreciate your guidance. Paul Howard senior fellow at the Manhattan Institute, director of health policy. He also was part of the advisory committee, I would imagine, advising on health care for Mitt Romney's 2012 presidential campaign, has testified before Congress many times. We thank him for being with us, and we also thank our earlier guest from the Washington Post for joining us to talk about where health care is, the status of it in the Senate at this moment, Paige Winfield Cunningham, and she writes the Health 202, Washington Post's health policy newsletter. Thanks very much to Colleen Leahy for producing this hour and to Lisa Nalbandian for on-air production here in our studios in Milwaukee. Don't worry, we'll have many more conversations. If you didn't get on the air, please go to our Facebook page and leave your comments there if you can. That's the Kathleen Dunn Show. We'll do more shows on this, and there will be many more chances for you to tell us what you think about it. News is coming up. Very interesting program matching students and seniors, hour two.